With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to continue with our exploration of the Nazi camp system. Particularly what we're going to look at today is how the Nazi state used propaganda to explain to the public the workings of the camp system, and how the German general public, by and large, was, at least in the early years, enthusiastic about the work of the camp system as they saw it, and how the Weimar German obsession with crime and law and order fed into these views. So in the last podcast that we did on this particular topic area of the Nazi camps before the war, which, as you know, has been an ongoing theme on the Explaining History podcast, we looked at the treatment of asocials, and we examined the fact that in the final years before the war, the majority of inmates in the camps had the asocial classification, and the majority of victims, the majority of fatalities in the camps between January 38 and August 39, there were 1,200 deaths were in the asocial category. So the camps became a place more than anything else, more than an instrument of political terror, more than an attack on the Jews before the war. They became a way of Hitler's social cleansing. They became a dumping ground for people who did not fit the model of what a productive Aryan citizen looked like. These were vagrants, petty criminals, people with drink and alcohol problems, mental health problems, physical health problems, and those who were long-term unemployed for one reason or another. However, the regime began to start to merge categorisations. There were not strict delineations between political and social enemies towards the end of the Second World War. Himmler spoke openly about, in 1933, having faced what he called a Jewish communist asocial organisation, which is the kind of the ultimate figment of Nazi imaginings and Nazi paranoia. The early camps had first concentrated on the destruction of the political left, but as time passed, they became focused on something that was actually, in some ways, perhaps more acceptable and widespread. A war against the people at the margins of society. Now, as this function changed, the official way that the camps spun their narrative changed as well. Nicholas Vachtman, in his book KL, writes, "Already in the mid-1930s, media reports placed growing emphasis on the detention of social outsiders. Most prominently was a five-page story on Dachau, published in late 1936 in a glossy Nazi magazine with 20 pictures of the camp and its inmates. Right from the beginning, the article stressed how much the prisoner population had recently changed, it said. These are no longer the political inmates of 1933, of whom only a small percentage is still in the camp, while the rest have long since been released, but for the most part a selection of social elements, recidivist political muddleheads, vagabonds, workshop persons and drunkards, emigres and Jewish parasites on the nation, offenders against morality of every kind, and a group of professional criminals on whom preventative police custody has been imposed. So this, to many German citizens who'd lived through the Weimar years, was quite an attractive message. The prisoners were being educated through military discipline, rigorous cleanliness. There was, once again, as I referred to this before, this Himmler obsession with cleanliness and hygiene, and a presumption that people who lived not lifestyles which were an anathema to the Nazis were in some way unhygienic. And also, of course, work. That they had tried to avoid all their lives, they had shunned, would be transformative. They would suddenly learn to set aside their own selfish petty needs and to work in the interests of the racial community. The Nazis were at pains to demonstrate that prisoners were basically well treated. They were healthy, they were well fed, they didn't suffer from SS brutality, and in many cases the Nazis argued these prisoners had it better inside, a better life inside than they would ever have had living on the streets or in slums or wherever they came from. Again, this was a reassuring message to people who perhaps felt a little bit unsure about Nazism. These were people who could look at the official justifications for what was happening and tell themselves an attractive myth. They could tell themselves that the Nazis were actually doing right by these poor unfortunates, and it was really the best thing for them, and that nothing else really was going to cure society's ills. People very often in the early 1930s, well, the first part of the Nazi regime, flocked to official justifications for the camps and were happy to consume any line that they were presented with. And one thing that was abundantly clear that was that for some prisoners there would never be the possibility of release, and that they would be incarcerated forever for the good of themselves and for the good of the national community. The Nazi propaganda basically told a simple story that without the permanent presence of an oppressive state, society could never be at peace, could never be free, and could never be safe. And so it required these measures in order to save the entire racial community from waves of crime. And crime was an overriding obsession in Weimar society, had been, and also in the society that the Nazis attempted to build. It was understandable that in the first 6 months of the regime, when the brown shirts go on the rampage and Germany appears to be even more lawless than ever, that that Hitler was anxious to quickly intervene and try to do something to curb the excesses of the brown shirts, which obviously ultimately results in the Night of the Long Knives, because of this fear that the German public would see Nazism as a lawless continuum of the Weimar years, ignoring for the fact that during the Weimar years the Nazis were responsible for a considerable amount of said lawlessness. But anyway, Nicholas Waschmann writes, Weimar society had been fixated on crime, especially during its final years, with an ever louder chorus clamouring for harsher measures against deviants. The Third Reich could build on this noxious legacy even with some political prisoners supporting the indefinite detention of selected social outsiders. Nazi media reports about the KL exploited existing prejudices, with staged photos of prisoners in menacing poses and covered in tattoos. While I walked through the camp, in the 1936 magazine feature about Dachau declared, we often encounter the type of the typical face of the born criminal, playing on popular beliefs in physiognomic theories. Such stories had some impact on the Third Reich, perpetuating the image of the camps as places full of dangerous deviants and strengthening the common conviction that Hitler had made the streets safe again, a myth that long outlived the Nazi regime inside Germany. However, as with so many things in Nazi Germany, obsession drifts into apathy in the minds of the general public. But in the second half of the 1930s, this acute fascination with the camps is, you know, what goes on behind those walls, who goes in there, what do they do, what have they done, these sorts of questions really give way to indifference. Even those that had once been political enemies of the regime, the former SPD and KPD men and women who had perhaps managed to evade incarceration and had were now trying to live life below the radar, a great deal of indifference emerges. The as Rushman puts it, the novelty of the camp had long worn off. On top of this, the detainees came from the margins of society. Now, there were people being detained who often weren't particularly sympathetic characters. People with addiction problems or people with all sorts of complex social issues who, for whom educated and urban professional individuals who may well have had oppositional thoughts to the regime were less likely to kind of empathise with, connect with and care about. And these were individuals who were also arrested away from the public eye. People who were arrested in poorer suburbs or slums in German cities and could be quickly and anonymously bundled into the back of a van. And when there were even mass raids against asocials and the criminal classes, as previously mentioned in the previous podcast, there was potential for the SPD in exile to make a great deal of capital out of this. But this goes largely unreported by them. Of course, this is largely unreported by the German press, because the German press is effectively muzzled, if not self-censoring. The wider trend that we can identify here is one of the camps slowly kind of disappearing, vanishing from public life, from public attention and public focus. They simply become part of the infrastructure of the everyday and part of the everyday experience. They become part of the new normal, and when things become part of the new normal, then there is little reason to question or challenge them. Now, if we talk about the propaganda victories of the Third Reich, which is a kind of very fraught area, a very questionable area, this is certainly one of them. The greatest achievements of the regime of people like Joseph Goebbels is the normalization of the previously abnormal.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And the incorporation of the machinery of totalitarianism into the experience of the everyday, and its naturalization, the natural assumption that is, of course, where, you know, bad sorts of people are sent, and it is probably for the best, so there's not much else to say on the subject. Prisoners who were released were understandably reluctant to say anything for fear of re-arrest, and fewer were released towards the end of the decade. Those who did were perhaps unable to really break through and make themselves heard. There was such a small audience in order to receive them. There were their friends and families who perhaps didn't want to hear, didn't want to know. The organised left had been devastated by the regime. And the trauma that they had experienced was, to some degree, indescribable. It was, to some degree, impossible to make people realise the enormity of what was going on in the camps. And, of course, there were large numbers of people who either didn't wish to hear or simply rationalised the camps as they once had done. However, the most important factor was that the audience for these reports was shrinking because of the growth in popularity of the regime. Despite the fact that in the first few years of the regime, popularity was faltering due to a failure to adequately address the economy, by the years 36 to 38, there was an influx of government spending into the economy to stimulate the arms industry. And as a result, this led to a wider enthusiasm to embrace the regime and to overlook the eggs broken in order to make the omelette, so to speak. The population didn't completely forget the camps. It didn't completely forget the stories of terror inside. In the public mind, of course, the camps are associated with abuse. People aren't naive enough to assume that there isn't violence in the camp. However, the population who is at least resigned to the Nazis or adjusted to Nazi rule or reasonably content with the Nazis accept that there will be a price to pay, and of course it's not being paid by them. So what the camps represent in the public mind by the end of the 1930s is a kind of a very unpleasant kind of bargaining. The unfortunate side effect of helping society to deal with its problems. This was a kind of a widespread rationalisation. The regime didn't necessarily want the camps to be too high profile. They were content for the camps gradually to blend into the background. They had been useful as a high profile feature in the first part of the 1930s. However, as the decade wore on, it became more and more expedient for a sense of normalcy to restore itself. Much as in the Soviet Union, where the camps were meant to be as far out of sight and out of the public mind as possible. In Nazi Germany, the camps could gradually fade away. There was the occasional reminder, when necessary, that they were there as kind of powerful tools that the state employed. However, the regime had no desire to bring the camps back into the media limelight. There was no need for rehabilitating the reputation of the camps, particularly as rumours, as we said, you know, the public discourse around the camps gradually kind of ebbs away. And there needed to be a certain degree of ambiguity about the camps. The government needed to be able to deny that the camps were a source of violence. But there always needed to be that kind of degree of ambiguity of the possibility that perhaps they might be, in order to prevent kind of a complacency on the part of the general public. Fashman writes, "The Nazi authorities were still unsure about the popularity of the KL, despite their alleged contribution to the Nazi fight against crime. Barely a week after the big Dachau photo spread had appeared in 1936, the authorities even issued a secret order to cut down on press reports about incidents inside the camps, such reports, Reich Press Chief Otto Dietrich announced confidentially, are apt to trigger damaging effects at home and abroad." So it's interesting that foreign perceptions of Germany were important to Germany. It was quite sensitive to how it was being perceived. The regime had become obviously very good at managing knowledge about the camps inside Germany, but foreign opinions harder to manipulate and harder to control. The Nazis obviously try. They attempted to improve the camp image abroad. And famously in 1935, they invited the British Royal British Legion to make a tour of Dachau. For those of you who are listening around the world, the Royal British Legion is the British Veterans Institution here in the UK, Veterans Charity here in the UK, that was established after the First World War with the help of Field Marshal Haig, who'd obviously done so much to create maimed and crippled veterans. The deception worked well, and it was almost a leaf out of the Stalinist playbook. The Soviet Union, at roughly the same time, was busy inviting naive Western democratic socialists to the Soviet Union to have a look at the wonderful work of Stalinism, even while the after effects of famines were still devastating large parts of Russia and Ukraine. So the deception on the British Legion worked. The British Legion, correspondent for the British Legion, said that every SS man was out to help any prisoner to make the best of himself and the situation. This was put in a memorandum to the British Foreign Office. One might be startled by the naivety of such statements. But in fact, when there were organisations of veterans in Britain and Germany, perhaps slightly more genuine intentions on the British part than in Germany, looking to find common ground and looking to find kind of some sort of reconciliation after the First World War, it was quite easy for those organisations, especially at a time of high anxiety and a great deal of fear about Hitler's intentions and the possibility of a second war, it was very easy for those organisations to see what they wished to see. Overall, however, the view in Britain's newspapers, as Richard Overy writes in The Morbid Age, is overwhelmingly negative of Nazi Germany, and popular opinions in Britain are overwhelmingly negative as information of state terror leaks out quite easily. The foreign criticism of the camp really tended to coalesce around the fate of specific political prisoners, because that's obviously always an easier story to tell. And if you can look at some of the human rights abuses of our time, they normally centre around a particular individual. In Britain, the ongoing public appeals for the political prisoner Hans Litten led the German ambassador to conclude that his discharge would make the position of the Third Reich significantly improved in terms of public opinion. The regime rebuffed all demands for his release, and at a speech at the Nuremberg rally in 1935, Goebbels denounced Litten as one of the main Jewish enemies behind the global communist conspiracy. In another more high-profile case, the Nazis partially gave in to foreign pressure. And this was the case of the pacifist Karl von Ossietzky, for whom there was a campaign to award him a Nobel Prize. He was a prisoner at Esterwegen camp from February 1933 onwards, but was seriously ill with a heart condition. Theodor Eich, the camp administrator for the entire system, knew that Ossietzky was dying, but advised Himmler not to free him anyway. And this was agreed with Heydrich, as he would become an irritant to the SS and somebody who would be able, if freed and possibly even exiled overseas, to cause all sorts of mayhem for the regime. Eventually, Goering overruled both of them, concerned about bad publicity in 1936, the year of the Olympics, and he was taken to a Berlin hospital where he lived and died 2 years later under strict police guard. He had learned before his death that he had been awarded the Nobel Prize and was pressurised by the Nazis to turn it down. However, even though under intense pressure, Ossietzky accepted the award, but he was banned from leaving Germany in order to accept it, and he died age 48 on May the 4th, 1938, his physical health having never fully recovered from his experience in the camps. So there we have it. This is the first of several podcasts this week. Hopefully we'll return to the camp system soon, and we'll start focusing a little bit more eventually on the camps during wartime. Thanks very much for listening. I look forward to catching you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.